Support for MPB comes from the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson. What Became of Dr. Smith by artist Noah Satterstrom is on view beginning April 20th. Learn more at msmuseumart.org.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Welcome to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Radio, where each week we talk to a musician, artist, author, or other creative Mississippian working in the arts across the state. I'm your host, Leslie Barker, Arts-Based Community Development Director at the Mississippi Arts Commission. And today, I'm speaking with visual artist and founder director of Friends of the Chactuma Swamp, Robin Whitfield. Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. We have so much to talk about, but we're going to just go to the beginning of it all. And I just want to hear a little bit about how you grew up. We're from the same hometown, Clinton, Mississippi. And I would just love to hear what started your career as an artist.
I think to myself, how lucky I am to have been born in Clinton and to my parents and live on my street, because it formed me. My mom is an artist and taught eighth grade art. Starting when I was in the third grade, she started teaching in the Clinton Public Schools. And so that was hugely informative to have. I just thought all kids had like a studio to play in with paintbrushes and paint and, you know, all my mom's art friends. And she, you know, so that she ended up going to get her master's at Mississippi College too, when I was in maybe fourth or fifth grade. And she would take me to classes, night classes, you know, and I remember sitting in her drawing classes and Dr. Gore, and I don't even know who all, but that was my normal world. And then she also allowed me to go on all the field trips that her classes would take even when I was younger. So we went to, this was way before the Walter Anderson Museum, but because my mom was an art teacher, she knew about Walter Anderson, and she took us down, you know, she allowed me to go to the coast with them where they could get the key and go look at his little house with the little room and the community center and stuff like that. So, I mean, that was hugely informative. And then, you know, road trips where we always had to hit a museum or some kind of weird, funky, a folk artist maybe that she knew about on one of our road trips. And so that was huge. And then our neighborhood had lots of cool creative people. One in particular was Wyatt Waters. So I just, you know, mom and I would often on a weekly basis just, you know, walk down to his house, or I'd ride my bike and there he'd be out in his yard painting or working on his greenhouse or something like that. And so to me, art, being an artist and art, just seemed like a normal thing. But now looking back, you know, on how did I become the artist that I am, meaning I work outside in the landscape, loving nature, you know, watching Wyatt and knowing Walter Anderson is really my first two kind of real artists that I knew about. What they both had in common was working directly from life and with watercolor. So that just kind of, I think, seared itself inside of me as that's what artists do.
So that's definitely something I want to hear more about, that you paint on location. Is that always what you do? And your medium is watercolor, right? Or your fate maker?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, 80 to 90% of the time, that is true. I think like all creative people, I'm highly experimental, and I do like to play with found pigments. But honestly, that's watercolor too. When I do find a pigment in a plant or like a mineral pigment just in the earth, that's what certainly was in traditional paint. But, you know, I add water to that and play with it as well. So I do play with that a good bit. But I like to play with all kinds. You know, if I have a medium in front of me, I will play with it. But, you know, I consider it pretty much strictly play. Watercolor is what I use in most of my, what I would just call the work that I'm really serious about. Maybe that's not quite the right word, I'm being serious, because I'm trying to learn to be very playful, but it's the medium I use to really stretch myself and try to communicate my ideas and really kind of be in dialogue with nature. That's where I feel like I'm most fluid with watercolor.
Was watercolor your first kind of medium that made you fall in love with being an artist, or did you get there later?
Those are really good questions. Watercolor was probably something I've always done. From this point, I can't even remember a time that I wasn't painting with watercolor. My mother painted with watercolor. And so, you know, for me, it was a very natural, it's just I was able to speak, you know, like if you can talk about painting, like you would talk about learning another language, I learned to speak watercolor at a very early age. So it's like when you don't really sometimes learn, you know, you don't think about when did I learn to speak English, you know. I've just always painted watercolor, so it was natural to me. But I'll say I shouldn't say I gave it up for a while, but I did it pretty seriously during high school. But when I went to college, I ended up studying at Delta State with Sammy Britt, and he wanted us to use oil paints exclusively so he could give us the kind of, I guess, direction that he knew how to give us, because oil was his media. So, but the idea was, he told us the paint didn't matter anyway. It was learning how to see and letting nature show us what it looks like versus having preconceived notion. And we were just going to use oil. So once we learned how to speak that color language, you know, we could go off and maybe apply that to any medium we want. So I didn't pick watercolor back up until a couple of years after college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
If you just tuned in, I'm Leslie Barker with the Mississippi Arts Commission. And today on the Arts Hour, I'm talking with my guest, Robin Whitfield. So Robin, talking about, you know, using the medium of watercolor, I love that idea of it being a language that you learned very young. Did you always paint nature, or was that, you know, also something you came across later?
You know, I have always been drawn to nature from a very young age. My mother sometimes laughs and just says, Robin, where did you come from? But I remember her even letting me stay home from school one day because there were these certain flowers blooming and I wanted to go paint them. And I can't believe my mother is a school teacher and she let me stay home because she knew I was really going to go paint the flowers. But I have always really honed in on nature, you know, but I will say, I mean, if any listeners out there have ever tried watercolor, or I guess tried to, or even any media and tried to interpret nature as a young artist, nature was very overwhelming for me. Like when I say nature, if I sat into a forest and I was looking at 50 trees and all the grasses and flowers, I was very frustrated. My attempts at trying to paint it I was never very satisfied. Having Walter Anderson's work really did help me, like, you know, because he had this great stylized view of nature that kind of broke things down into geometry. And I wasn't really able to do that until many years later in any kind of way where I'm able to distill what I'm really after. Because, you know, there's a learning curve. I had to really understand how to use watercolor with a fluidity that you just can't have when you're first beginning. But I did. I had lots of awkward attempts at painting using small things like a leaf or a mushroom or a dragonfly, something I could hone in on versus maybe a complexity of relationships. I've gotten to where, you know, I think at Delta State, Sammy talked to us a lot about painting as simply relating one color to another or a shape. You know, you couldn't think of painting outside of relationships. And that's how I also think about nature. I mean, or life in general. Everything is, you can't see one thing without seeing what's next to it. You know, when a color changes when another color is put next to it. And so is everything, and certainly in nature. It's just so clear in nature. So now, you know, and I'm still growing in that understanding. I started at a pretty early age with thinking about those things. Another really wonderful thing I had happen as a teenager is I knew Sammy Britt before I entered college. And so to have a master teacher from the time I was 15 made a huge difference in him helping me take something that could, you know, such a huge topic like nature, and began to help me take baby steps towards understanding it and kind of in a way that did not, that made total sense and built a big foundation for me to work from. So anyway, my mother signed me up for his workshop at MC. It was an adult workshop, but he let me come in on that workshop at 15. And oh, so wow. I started studying with him the last 2 years of my high school years. You know, he would come and teach every summer. So I really got a really strong start in a certain kind of thinking and working directly with nature.
You know, I love hearing about how you started being an artist from, you know, if you grew up in Clinton, you know, Miss Whitfield was the art teacher and everybody knows Wyatt statewide, you know, especially in Clinton. And also, you know, obviously talking about Walter Anderson, not necessarily Clinton, but Mississippi for sure. And how all of that influenced you. How, what other ways do you say Mississippi finds its way into your work?
I can't even, like, I can't imagine living somewhere other than Mississippi at this point in my life, but I never could imagine it because to me, Mississippi was just a presence, almost like an entity or a being. I mean, I can't, when I think about Mississippi, I think of the, you know, the forest and the fields and the rivers. So the land itself is so powerful, but, you know, connected to the land, like it's, I've been trying to unpack these very questions. Like, is just a part of my philosophy as a human and an artist. And I think about it a lot. And now that I've gotten into natural materials, just kind of looking at the source of color or the source of tools. And I look at maybe the native peoples that lived here. And then I look back, reflect back on my work now. And I just see how much a place can really affect, how you see the world in general. I just know that I'm extremely steeped in Mississippi, and and I like my audience to be Mississippi. I've never been, you know, because as an artist, we all, I guess, have to have an audience, or we want an audience, whether you're a musician or writer or painter. I wouldn't have thought this as a younger person needing another person to see my work to complete it. But another artist mentioned that to me years ago, and I really realized how true that is. So for me, I've realized I like Mississippians to see my work in particular, because they have a certain resonance with what I'm painting, even if, particularly if they see it, but they've never seen it, like really seen it. Maybe they encounter the plants or animals or landscape, but if I show them something that they kind of take for granted each day, but then through my painting they really see it. I love watching that wash over someone and have them tell me a story about a certain kind of plant or a certain place that they have direct experience with, and this showed them something that they either remembered, recalled, or maybe never saw in the first place. So I just love my audience being Mississippi, and so I've made it where I don't really try to have a lot of shows outside the state. Mm-hmm. I've tried to find ways to have my work reach really regular people, not even, I'm in Karen Gallery in Tupelo, which I love being in a Mississippi gallery commercially. But my real interest in showing work is really more about being in public spaces or, and maybe just, I'm still trying to even figure that out, but I love having a Mississippi audience. And so that's really important to me.
No matter if you use an app to start your car or still have a flip phone, Everyday Tech can decipher today's technology for tomorrow's solutions. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or the MPB Public Media app.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
You're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Radio. Each week on the Arts Hour, representatives from the Mississippi Arts Commission speak with different creative Mississippians. Today, I'm talking with artist Robin Whitfield. So Robin, right before the break, we were talking about your painting and the different styles of painting and the mediums, and you mentioned using natural materials. I want to hear all about that. Tell us all about the natural materials.
All right. I'm going to tell y'all that that's sort of been a surprise to me as an artist to all of a sudden start thinking about what is pain and where did it come from. But I think I can only say that from the time I graduated from college and I ended up moving over to Grenada, I discovered a wetland just a few blocks from where I was living, and I began going there every day. And that's where I was really also stumbling around trying to figure out watercolor at that point, because I realized especially while I was in school in Delta State, there aren't many trees in Bolivar County. And when I came over to Grenada, and there was the forest was so amazing, and I'd been so hungry for trees, I didn't even know it. I couldn't get enough of just being in a forest. And so I spent a lot of time, and I really wanted to use watercolor so it would be easy to take out with me, and it would dry fast, because oil paint is not easy to take with you in the field, especially if you're going through a lot of underbrush and stuff. So I had this high motivation and want to get back to my roots of watercolor. But I'd say, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years into just really working on my watercolor and getting more fluid with it, I got my first kayak. And I'm mentioning the kayak because that's when I first had this moment, you know, with that big accident that you have that turns into be your revelation. I'm sure we all do that all the time. But I was like out painting in my kayak, and I had my watercolor. I was kind of proud of it. It was going really well. You know, you should probably never think those thoughts in your head like, ooh, I like this, because the wind picked it up right at that moment and like plopped my watercolor face down in the swamp. I was in the swamp out there in Grenada. And so when I pulled up the painting, it was coated with just this brown, just whatever is on the surface of swamps. You know, I'm gonna call it your swamp goo. And and I was, of course, heartbroken at first, but I mean, I don't know, I just, maybe I'd been thinking a lot about, who knows, I mean, I do love nature to the point where I was curious about that. I go, what is that, you know, kind of, what is that on the paper? But I saw it within, you know, just not even, it didn't even take me a minute to realize, wow, that is a beautiful color. And oh my gosh, I didn't know that. I didn't know the surface looked like that. And I, you know, could I do that intentionally? And, you know, so it started me really thinking about color on the landscape, where pigment comes from, how, you know, and wanting to then kind of interact and question nature itself. I'm like, wow, what color are you, and what do you have in there, and what are you made of, and like where is, so it even felt exciting, like a way to dialogue more directly with nature itself in a very play, you know, because it's kind of like a surprise, like I had, you know, you don't, I saw sort of squishing berries on paper, or rubbing a flower on paper, or just looking at dirt and picking it up. If I could get a color to come off onto the paper easily, I would try it, and mushrooms and algae and just anything I could find. And anyway, so it just became just very entertaining, and it showed, you know, it showed me nature, or showed me things that I kind of either didn't notice at all, or something that maybe I'd taken for granted, or just didn't fully explore. It gave me this new way to understand it and see it. It's kind of like when you're getting to know a new friend, and they just finally tell you like a childhood story or something, you know, where you're learning more about it, and you see that person differently, like, oh, you know, that's how I was feeling about nature through working with these natural pigments. And I've always been a big fan of art created by traditional cultures. I mean, and of course, it finally occurred to me that all art created before the, at least probably not even 200 years ago, like 150 years ago, had been created with natural pigments. So I probably was told that in art history class, and I didn't hear it properly, you know? Mm. And, it just blew my mind, and it made me look at all art differently. I really dove into Aboriginal art about that time, and I'd always loved Chinese brush painting. But, you know, you just don't think about, you know, all art materials coming directly from some source of the earth, and that culture itself is born of what the people who live in a certain place, what they have access to, or what they can trade for, you know. And that makes you look at the Renaissance differently. And you know, now I can go back and read about Michelangelo. He couldn't afford, you know, a certain blue, and so he'd have to wait till someone would buy it for him to add it into his paintings, you know. It's just it you know, and that coming from a certain stone and a certain part of the world. I think maybe that from the Middle East. I can't, you know, remember that exactly where some of foreign pigments are. I'm very interested in that, but I must say I'm extremely interested in just what's right in front of me, nature itself. And so I've delved into kind of looking about, you know, what natural materials have been used throughout history. But what it comes down to is I've realized I'm not so interested in making my own paint, or say making my own tools that I want to use on a daily basis, like to do my watercolor. I'm truly interested in natural materials because of the deeper relationship it gives me to a place, a sense of place. Because I'm looking at nature, when I say nature, that's such a vague term. I like to go to a place like Lee Tartt Nature Preserve or Tallahatchie National Wildlife Refuge. These are places right around me. And I want to feel the collective, all the living things, the ecosystem, how they interact, their relationship, and me as a part of that. And so to me, playing directly with the materials is a way of interacting in a way it's a way of communicating outside of language for me.
You're listening to MPB Think Radio. This is the Mississippi Arts Hour, and I'm your host, Leslie Barker, talking with artist Robin Whitfield. Now, Robin, you were just talking about places that are important to you, and I really got to know you through some of your community work with those places, one of which being the Chattuma Swamp. So I would love for everybody to hear about the work that you have been doing through conservation and art with the swamp.
Oh, sure. Probably the place I've spent the most time over the past 25 years is a place that is now called Chattuma Swamp. It's a 300-acre wetland that's, I'd say, no more than 4 or 5 blocks from my studio, and it's a place owned by the city of Grenada. So I've been going out there and just exploring, painting, just discovering what a wetland is, what nature is, who I am. And so over the past, I'd say 10 years, or maybe I would say in 2009, I approached the city directly about forming a friends group and taking care of this 300 acres. Not in a huge way at that point. I was just thinking we could put some trails out there, pick up trash. At that point, I didn't even know hardly what it meant to take care of. I never really pondered it that deeply, but they were very enthusiastic. They encouraged me and helped me when they could. We ended up finding some really cool plants out there and realized we had a pretty intact ecosystem. I got the state involved, and I got them involved with the National Heritage Area Program just to have someone agree with me that this is a cool place, because you can get emotionally attached to stuff and think it's something that it's not, you know. But I had them agree that, oh, wow, this is a really, really cool spot. So I'm kind of setting the stage for what's ended up happening over the past few years. So it's that place I can just always count on. If I'm having a busy week or not, I mean, I can just easily access nature. And I think that's really important. For us in Mississippi, most of us have pretty easy access to nature. Growing up in Clinton, I realize now I didn't have as easy access as I do here in Grenada, but I could always get up on the Natchez Trace or run down to Rocky Springs, or just, you know, play in the woodlot behind our house, which is now a neighborhood. The Clinton Nature Center didn't exist then, and I played in it's there now as a nature center. But anyway, but it's not, you know, I'm realizing, you know, this easy access is important. And so that's part of my motivation of wanting to have these trails for the city is like, wow, look at this great little place that school kids could come to or just residents could, because it's right across from our downtown. Well, as my life had gotten pretty busy about, I'd say about 5 years ago, just the normal stuff of trying to be an artist and figuring out how to make my living teaching and traveling and selling art. And so it just became more and more, I just went down there to paint, and I had really set up a week to go paint out there, I'd say in the fall of 2015, maybe. And I showed up and there were timber harvest ribbons everywhere around the properties, the city's property. And I could go on and on about that story, but I basically found out later that day, I just actually stopped my painting project entirely, ran down to City Hall and found out that the city had decided to cut all of their properties, not just that property. Oh, wow. And so that was a huge turning point in my life. Without even questioning it, I just dove right into trying to see what could be done about that. And the city gave me the opportunity to speak at council meetings on multiple occasions. And I really tried to make a case to save this particular 300 acres because of its proximity to town and all these cool plants and animals that live there that the state had also recognized as cool. And So anyway, this began, I didn't even know I was, you know, I just kind of jumped into the world of conservation without even knowing that's what I was doing. You know, I was an artist who loved a place and who had been in dialogue with the place. And that is sort of the danger of loving something or doing art, you know, art makers. And when I say art, all people are artists, and I could have a whole conversation about that. But we all have a, you know, we all lean towards interacting with the physical world in a deeper way. Some people do it in the kitchen. Some people do it with a musical instrument. Some people like to dance or twirl. Or, you know, we have these things, but these things, you know, have us come to love something. And so sometimes people are just good parents. And I know that people probably feel this way about their children. You just don't question it. And so I didn't question it. I didn't think about what it would do to my art career or whatever. I just dove. I had the freedom, because I worked for myself, to just dive into trying to see what I could do to save this 300 acres from being harvested. And I used the tools that I had to do that were the only tools I had, which were, you know, art tools. I knew how to tell a story visually. I knew how to make strong graphic images that could affect people. I could draw maps, and I used everything I had that I had learned throughout all the years of my life to try to help people see the beauty and just the intricacy of what was right in front of them. And it's so funny, as I learned my community, first of all, they didn't even know where I was talking about. I'd have to say, you know, the swamp downtown. And you could finally get them to realize where you were talking about. It's a place we drive by all the time, and most people, no one had ever, you know, gotten out. Maybe they had when they were a kid. But it turned out to be a big community dialogue. Through my photography and paintings and in illustrations, I was really able to build a case that ended up saving that 300 acres. And I didn't do it alone. I mean, I got a lot of interest. But I'm going to say, I think the skills I had as an artist, which you kind of take for granted. I think a lot of people even don't even realize how powerful artists are. But we're able to show people things that maybe other people can't. Sometimes words, well, of course, then there's poets. You know, you can use words too. But I was able to get enough community and statewide support, and we were able to, ultimately, the way we saved the swamp is we had to buy all the trees. The city basically just gave us that option. They were willing to let us be the high bidder. And if we could purchase the trees, they would work with us on some sort of plan to save it and, that for longevity. So we ended up having a donor step up out of the woodwork after he heard the story and loan us the money to buy all the trees, and really also built a bridge of communication with the city, because we had kind of gotten a strained relationship the harder I pushed. So, but ultimately now, and I'm gonna give it, you know, credit to me being an artist, I was able to use creativity and love to get people to see something they could not see before, build relationships, you know, with our city itself, never burn bridges, but only, you know, build up on things. And now they're my biggest ally. We work together as a partnership. We have a lease, a 60-year lease on that property. When I say we, I ended up having to form a nonprofit to hold that lease. And we're called Friends of Chakchuma Swamp. And Chakchuma, y'all are thinking, well, what does that mean? So I'll just go on and tell you, I did not know the area that is the 300 acres. It had various names. When I started going there, I'd ask, well, what is this place? And people go, oh, that's Old Dump Lake. Or, oh, that's Fox Lake. There was not a name. And I really didn't like Dump Lake. And so anyway, I ended up, my little collective, we hosted a competition to name it. And so the Chakchuma Swamp came out of that competition, and the Chakchuma name was turned in multiple times because it turns out they're the native peoples of our area. So I'm very grateful that the Historical Society, they got behind it. They're the ones putting the name in more than once. And so now the swamp bears the name of the people that would have lived there, that would have used those very materials I'm so fascinated with now. You know, and so now I envision them out there using the same plant fibers and the same pigments that I now am interested in. And now their name gets to get back on our lips as we say Chakchuma, and it means red crawfish.
Oh, that's amazing. That's what a beautiful representation of a place, you know, and how, and also what a beautiful representation of how art can change things. And when we come back from the next break, I want to talk to you more about some of the projects, or one project in particular that the community got really involved in with the swamp and with art.
Hi, I'm Walt Grayson. You can now listen to the wild, weird, and wonderful stories of Mississippi with Mile Marker.
Some of the big names that travel up and down the highways, obviously Elvis and Johnny Cash, and you had Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins.
Join me as we hit the roads of Mississippi on Mile Marker.
Johnny Cash suggested that Carl write a song called Blue Suede Shoes. That was all kind of created with Aaron Amory.
You can listen by going to mpbonline.org/radio or by using your favorite podcasting app.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
You're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Radio. Each week on the Arts Hour, representatives from the Mississippi Arts Commission speak with different artists and all around creative Mississippians. Today, I'm speaking with visual artist Robin Whitfield. And Robin, right before the break, we were talking not just about your art, but your conservation efforts. And there was a project that you received a grant for from the Mississippi Arts Commission, which is one way I know about your work, that tied in your art and the conservation and brought the community in. So tell us about that project.
Yeah, okay. So I think you're referring to the Swamp Quilt Project. And
yes.
You know how you can just, we're sitting around in a board meeting actually last year, and I had a board member go, wouldn't it be so cool if we had like these cool quilts, so when we did field trips, people could sit on the ground, and then what if the quilts had cool, like, you know, each square might be educational, and it could be like a game, you know. It's like, and I love it when it comes from my board members, you know. And then my mind started going, and I just happen to know an amazing, not just any old quilt artist, but an amazing artistic quilt artist named Yolandi Van Heerden in Greenwood, and she and I worked together through a nonprofit over there. And so my mind just immediately ran with that. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I could just see and feel, I could just feel the crackling in the air of, ooh, yes. And so I thought, ooh, I might, you know, and Yolandi's also on the artist roster, I'm pretty sure. I was thinking, you know what, I think this would be a great Arts Commission grant, you know, project. And so I told her about the concept and she loved it. And what basically the concept ended up being, she and I kind of came up with it together. I always like to talk to the artist before I really, because I wanted it to be, I wanted to hire Yolandi Van Heerden to be our head artist. And I would be collaborating with her as Robin Whitfield artist and also as a director of Friends of Touching the Swamp. But I wanted her to be, you know, she and I are both used to working with community members and having them also showing them some sort of skill and having their unique take on things added into the mix. You know, she and I are very, you know, kind of, I guess we're very comfortable with that kind of flow. So I knew she would be a fun partner. So what we ended up doing or deciding is that we were going to pick 25, maybe it ended up being 26. It kept growing on us. I think it started with 14, you know, things just kind of, you know, with me and Yolandi, we can let things kind of, we can get into like this whirlwind of creativity. But I think we ended up with 26 plants and animals that you're pretty much guaranteed to see if you spend any time at Chakchuma Swamp. And just in case I call it Leichhardt Nature Preserve, Chakchuma Swamp is now located in what's called Leichhardt Nature Preserve. It got its new name during the course of the purchasing of the trees. So those others, if I say one or the other, they're the same place. Chakchuma Swamp is inside Leichhardt Nature Preserve. But anyway, so, you know, it's anything from like hummingbirds to, I'm the one who came up with the list. And I really tried to think about connections as I was making that list. Like I knew hummingbirds depended on jewelweed for nectar, and that things like water tupelo and cypress are two of the main trees there. And they attract like the pathonotary warbler, which is a threatened species and the mascot of our organization. So I was trying to think in terms of relationships so that the quilt would end up becoming each we ended up going from one quilt to four smaller quilts. The quilt became so huge, we decided it was going to weigh like 80 pounds. So we were going to make four smaller quilts. And then, because each square went from being like 10 by 10 to like 16 by 16. And I don't know, because we kept, so what the concept was, let me kind of go back to, so we had these 25, we have all these photographs of these 26 plants and animals. We invited the community to these work days or these workshops, and they got to, we made them draw a number out of a hat, okay? So they could just had to basically, whatever number they drew, you know, was attached to one of the plants or animals. And they had to go look at several of these photographs and look at all the fabric Yolandi had brought. She brought in all these amazing fabrics from South Africa, which is where she's from, as well as other American and Japanese fabrics, just a really beautiful collection. And they had to look at the photographs and not interpret the photograph literally, like depict it like a photograph, but get a sense of texture and color and relationship, and maybe also use what they know about those plants and animals. It's so funny, most people out of the 26 plants and animals, very few people who participated had ever even heard of them. And they're the most common plants and animals, you know, in the swamp. And so that was another really big plus on this project, is everyone learned what lived there. They got to have fun interpreting through color and texture the plant or animal. And then they got to design kind of these abstract quilt squares. And we were using kind of, Yolandi's really inspired by the G's Bend quilt style, which is very intuitive. You know, you're just putting color and texture and kind of creating a design that might reflect a shape or something, but it doesn't have to. It can just be, it's pure geometrical and kind of improv. It's nothing, it's not like one of those carefully where all the each square is going to have a matching pattern throughout the quilt. Every square is like its own unique little abstract work of art. So in the course of three workshops, we had community members pick out colors and kind of sew them. And Yolandi had brought sewing machines and showed us what to do. And anyway, we also ended up having in a different workshop, people hand embroider the name of each of the 26 plants and animals on pieces of khaki pants that people had donated also. We thought that would be the border strips in between, kind of looking like nice earthy grass colors or dirt colors, and make all the colorful squares pop. And it really worked. It's a beautiful, oh my God. And Yolandi and I were excited from that first hour of the first workshop. We were both beyond excited because we saw it was beyond our wildest hopes of who showed up, how it affected them, what they were doing. It was just wildly amazing. I mean, truly magical. I think Yolandi told me it was the most amazing project she'd ever done, which I hope she really means that, but because she does some pretty cool stuff. But anyway, so we're actually, the project, COVID happened right as we were finishing that project. And the last part of the project was to put it all together and quilt it. And we were gonna have these community quilting bees where we got together and quilted it as a community. By the time March came around and we were ready to quilt, you know, we couldn't get together. So Yolandi has actually been slowly quilting it herself through all this time. She's almost finished. And we are planning on actually featuring the four quilts at our Halloween. We're going to be having a Halloween trail walk on October 31st at Lee Tartt Nature Preserve. And so we're going to have these quilts featured at that event.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, and with Yolandi working on it during this time, what a beautiful picture of this strange time that you're going to have, and, you know, for future archives and just, you know, of art and of history of this moment. And, you know, you mentioned how you were so excited about the people that showed up. Who showed up? Like what ages and what?
It was just amazing because, you know, I'm sure if any of y'all listening try to do community events where you don't have a known set of people showing up, either no one shows up or it's all, everybody knows each other. But I'm going to say, my board, we were so pleased. We talked about how it was for a small town, it was a very diverse crowd, and like most people didn't know each other. It was, you know, we had like a Girl Scout troop show up. Oh, wow. We had, you know, a couple of artists show up. We had some school teachers show up. We had some older ladies who are a part of a quilting group in town show up. Let me think. And of course, our board, you know, various board members and volunteers that work with us on a more regular basis. But we had partnered with the public school to use one of their spaces for a Saturday in their Votech building. And so we tried to make it in a space where anyone might feel comfortable coming to it. That was a, you know, deep, we had to kind of think deeply about that, because I think that's a part of having a successful community event is making it easily accessible and where everyone feels welcome. So I felt like that the public school building was a good choice and had a lot to do with it. We had another event at the public library. Those might have been, and we ended up two of the workshops. One of the teachers invited us to come to her fourth and fifth grade gifted classroom, where she was set up with sewing machines already, and Yolandi brought in some more. And we had participants from the first workshop volunteered to help us with the fourth graders in the two workshops that kind of came as a surprise. So we probably had easily one-on-one adult to child, because the older quilters came in and some of our board members and just friends, and you know, just it was just this wild, amazing. Students of one of the teachers came. I mean, it was just this crazy excitement over this project, and the kids having those fourth graders, I mean, they dove right into picking fabrics, and they got to use sewing machines and make a whole square. I mean, it was just, and they had to do it collaboratively in teams. So, I mean, this is an extremely collaborative project, and where no one can claim a square as their own exactly, because most people just participated in one of the squares, maybe as a, you know, two or three person team. But the same, I would say each workshop we had a few people that were at each one, but we always had unique and new people come to each workshop.
Well, I can tell you, you know, from an outside perspective, that the community was very excited, because one morning, and I've told you this, but one morning I got to work and had a message on my phone from a gentleman from the community. He didn't say who he was, but just left the sweetest, most excited message about how much he loved this project, and just thanked the Mississippi Arts Commission for supporting this project, and was just over the moon about how it had gone. So I can't wait to see what happens with it when you're all able to get back together.
I know, me too. And I'm going to tell you, I've seen it kind of laid out and practically put together. You know, I mean, not quilted, but sewn together. And you know, it's like everything that becomes beautiful. We made these quilts. Remember, the original board member was one. We wanted quilts, functional quilts that we could put on the ground for school groups to sit on and then be inspired by as they sat there and tried to connect what they were seeing in the real world with what was on the quilt. But they're so beautiful. I can already feel myself wanting to be careful with them. But yet I don't want to be, you know, I really believe in having beautiful handmade art pieces. Be to me, it's that final, like I was talking about, my own art being seen. If we use these quilts, even if they end up getting some character on them because they get a stain of grass or dirt or get torn, I mean I'm trying to talk myself into this. I want us to use them, you know, and really have them, you know, just I guess deepen in their own personality and in our own imaginations by how they're used on site. So we'll see if I can. I'm always thinking maybe I can bring a tarp to lay down. That's ridiculous, but I'm anxious to also just see how they continue to, I guess, inspire and become a part of our programming. Because I feel like a really beautiful things like this that are touched by so many people. I don't know, just inspire all sorts of things that I can't even begin to guess. Mm.
Well, I know we probably have some people listening who are interested in what you do as a teacher and as a you know, workshop facilitator, and maybe want to get in on it themselves. So tell us how, you know, tell us about your workshops and then how people can find you.
Sure. So I've had as we all have this year of COVID, I've not been teaching many workshops, but that is something I typically do a good bit of. I do have some upcoming workshops in Greenwood coming up. Two of those workshops will be watercolor workshops, and two will be an outdoor adventure workshops where we will be doing some exploring of natural pigments. I developed a program called Delta Wild several years ago through Art Place, And so we're going to kind of revamp these Delta Wild excursions, inviting, you know, and they're for anybody, families, friend groups, just an individual who wants to come out. And we're going to be exploring the Yazoo Nature Trail on those. We do similar workshops with me or other people. I'm constantly, as an artist, I know so many artists and I know the power of art. So through Friends of Chukchuma Swamp, we also, you know, constantly have workshops going on. The one that I would mention, it's not me teaching, but since we're talking about it, I can't help but want to mention this. We have an upcoming workshop on Halloween. We're going to be doing a trail walk in the evening. But that morning, as a part of that trail experience, we've invited Sam Clark, an artist from Madison, to come up. He sculpts these amazing trolls and dragons as his profession. So he's going to lead a sculpting workshop of, you know, fantastical creatures. And then those who feel comfortable enough are going to be invited to sculpt a face on a tree.
Oh, wow.
And later that evening, those trees will be featured on our trail walk. So that's going to be fun on October 31st. If any listener thinks they want to come up to Grenada on Halloween, we invite anyone who wants to get their hands in some clay and get that dirty. And I'm always, you know, we had a cordage workshop recently that I didn't teach, but we had someone else come and show us how to get fibers from plants and turn that into ropes. So we're always doing something with Friends of Chukchuma Swamp, and all that can be seen on our website. I believe it's friends-of-cs.org. And then robinwhitfield.com is how you can find out about the very specific ones that I teach. I do teach a whole, you know, I very commonly teach these what I call earth color workshops or natural pigment workshops, different people who invite me to come and do them maybe might call them different things, but I don't have any planned, like there's nothing on the calendar right now, but I know that anyone can invite me to teach one or work with that with your group. I've been known to, you know, teach in, you know, museum settings or club settings, garden clubs and school groups, that sort of thing. I'm on the Mississippi artist roster too, through, you know, the Mississippi Arts Commission, through y'all, and can, which does help supplement funding for workshops for me.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susan Buttress, host of Southern Remedies, Relatively Speaking, a show that explores issues that relate to you and your family, from mental health obstacles and family interactions to handling life's disruptions. Whatever it is, we're here to help. Find out what we're all about and subscribe to the podcast by using any podcast app or by downloading our MPB Public Media app.